Joined now by Jack Levin, and he is a friend of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Jack, we appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us. Let us know how you found out the news tonight.
About 3 minutes after Ruth passed away, her son, James, who is a close friend of mine, as Marty and Ruth were, called me on this cell phone that I'm speaking into now. And I'm here working at my home during pandemic days. And he told me the sad news that 3 minutes before Ruth had passed away. He knew how hard I would take the news and how upset I would be. And he was so kind to have called me.
That must have been an extraordinary and painful moment for you, and obviously you're still processing like this news like so many others. Thank you for taking a minute to be with us. Can you do us a favor? You knew her on a very different level to outsiders. She's this huge judicial and legal and feminist figure. You knew her on a much more intimate level. Talk about Ruth, the woman, the person, the friend.
Well, Ruth and Marty were a perfect couple. Ruth was brilliant. Ruth had all the right instincts. She was warm and genuine, and she had a desire to improve an imperfect world all the time. And her husband, Marty, was outspoken, jovial, cracking a joke every 5 minutes. They were both brilliant. She quiet, and he quite outspoken. And they made a perfect couple. They did everything together, and they had a wonderful life together. They had two wonderful children that I've known since I met them when their children were like young teenagers. And the time that I met them was so interesting. Marty was a lawyer. Harvard Law School. Ruth was a lawyer from Harvard Law School, and I was a few years after them, so I didn't know them at Harvard Law School. But I had the occasion in the mid-1970s to be asked to give a speech in Hawaii. What a nice place. And they told me that if I gave the speech, I would be speaking together with another tax lawyer, whose name was Martin D. Ginsburg. And so Marty and I ended up meeting on the stage in front of 450 people and giving a three-hour speech about several tax topics. Now, at that time, his wife was not with him because she was too busy to go to Hawaii. She was back in New York acting as a member of ACLU and as a law professor. And a year or two later, when Marty and I continued to give speeches, we ended up giving maybe 100 speeches during the rest of his career and my career. When we gave additional speeches, she often came along, both Ruth and my wife, Sandy, and we would have a wonderful time. She was a brilliant person with just all the right instincts to make it a better world. And she was a great success, first as a law professor, later as an appellate judge, and then finally as a Supreme Court judge. She stood for all that I believe was good and right: human rights, gender equality, honesty, and integrity. Now, she was a very soft-spoken and reserved person, and as I said, Marty was an outgoing person, gregarious, telling jokes, and she was forever saying, "Oh, Marty, knock it off." And at one point, I remember he ordered a drink when we were all out to dinner, and he turned to the waitress and said, "Oh, and bring my mother some wine, please." And she did not laugh. All the rest of us laughed.
Jack. Jack, I mean, these memories that you have with her are so touching and so personal, and we thank you so much for sharing them with us. Did she ever share with you what she was most proud of personally and also professionally? What made her the most happy?
Well, I want to tell you one thing first, then I'll come to that. She was so hardworking that you can't conceive of it. Here she was, one of the nine justices of the United States Supreme Court. For a lawyer, that's pretty close to becoming God. And so most Supreme Court justices will look at the briefs for the next day's cases, skim through them, and I suspect that Ruth wins the World Series prize for the person who spent the most time every night reading the briefs for the next day's Supreme Court arguments. Because there would be substantial briefs filed by the plaintiff and by the defendant, and frequently by amicus, that is, people who are neither plaintiff nor defendant but want to add something to the argument. And my wife Sandy and I, when we would be in Washington, we would go over to their house for dinner. And Marty, who was a wonderful cook, he was the cook of the family. She wasn't. She was the intellect of the family. She was the one who was reading those briefs. We would probably arrive there at like 5:30 in the afternoon to have dinner at their house. And she would be upstairs in her den reading briefs for the next day's Supreme Court argument. Marty would cook. I would help him. And he would announce dinner's ready. She would come down. We'd have an hour and a half or so of brilliant discussion. And she would then go back up the stairs and continue reading, sometimes till 2 o'clock in the morning, while Marty would drive us back to our hotels in our hotel in Washington. She made it a point to read all the briefs for every case she sat on so that she could ask the most intelligent questions to the lawyers who were arguing the case. And so here she was, a tremendous success in life and just about the hardest working person you can imagine.
Jack, can you sum up for us what you think the impact of her legal decisions have had on society and what this loss means overall to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's so obvious that this is a really tough time to have a transition of this sort where there's going to be another open seat on the Supreme Court. I don't want to take political sides on this. I think there are interesting issues on both the Democratic side and the Republican side. And while I have my own strong feelings, I don't want to take sides on them. I just want to say that the court is fairly evenly divided now. And with Ruth's passing, there will probably be quite a scramble now as to whether there is a candidate who is now nominated from the other side of the bench, which could switch the majority over from one side to the other. And there are, of course, only a few months to go before a presidential election. And if the presidency were to change, there's only a couple of months for there to be a nominee and a confirmee who is from the opposite side of the bench than Ruth. And so I think it's going to have a significant effect on our nation for the next 3 or 4 months, because we won't know for several months what the election will bring. And so this may be the last time, may or may not be the last time, when there is a president of one party and an opening for what could be a majority on the Supreme Court who was enamored of the other side of the fence on many issues.
And obviously, I'm sorry, Jack, go ahead.
So Ruth's attitude at the age of, I think it's 87 or 88 right now, Ruth's attitude has always been, I will continue serving on the Supreme Court, doing my very best for my nation, for my country, and for the world, as long as I feel mentally capable of doing so. And I want to tell you, because I've spent time with her, over the years, including as recently as a few months ago. I want to tell you that even at her age, she was had great mental acuity, and she was still capable of doing the job. And she wanted to be there in order to, and she kept reading briefs. She kept listening to oral arguments and asking questions. And it's going to be a loss to the Supreme Court to have a person of her intellect and her ability and her perseverance there to do what she's done. And obviously it'll be of great interest and some degree fear with some people in our country for the next several months over what the replacement will be and what the numerical numbers will be on the Supreme Court. I do want to mention one other thing. That is that her best friend on the Supreme Court, was a person exactly on the opposite end of things, but a person whom she went to Harvard Law School with. And they always got along extremely well on the Supreme Court. That is Nino Scalia, who was, as you probably will recall, on the opposite side of most of the issues than Ruth was. And that just demonstrates how both Nino Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the kind of extraordinary people who held no harshness, no hostility with respect to people who believed differently than they did. They were both brilliant. I served on the Law Review with Nino Scalia. Nino Scalia, who served on the Law Review with Ruth before him and then with me, we were all close friends. And while he had one set of views on many issues, and Ruth had a completely different view, they were genuinely the closest of friends. The Ginsburg and the Scalia families, virtually every New Year's Eve, spent that evening together in one of their apartments. So that they could be together as warm friends, and they never held a harshness or a hostility, even though they disagreed on certain women's rights and on certain gun rights and certain other things in the court. And so what that demonstrated to me is that fine people who disagree with each other can get along with each other, can be the closest of friends, can respect each other. And I only hope that that example is one for our country, so that our country, which is now somewhat divided, can move forward and can move more toward cooperating with people who are on the other side of the fence in an honest way. That, of course, is what both Marty Ginsburg and Ruth Ginsburg and Nino Scalia would have wanted.
And Jack, that is so beautifully said. I think there's probably a lot that we all could learn from the relationship between those two in terms of can disagree, but still on a personal level forge what obviously was a tight friendship. Last question, just two quick parts. One, did you have any idea that she was near death in these last few days? And part two, knowing her on a personal level, did she ever, I know you just mentioned at length her extraordinary work ethic, did she ever give any thought at all to stepping down while a Democrat was in the White House? Because it isn't certainly a stretch to believe she would not want Donald Trump or any other Republican picking her replacement necessarily. Did she ever give any political consideration at all to stepping down in order to preserve some kind of political composition of the court, or did she rule that out entirely?
Well, to answer that second question first, I believe that her attitude always was that as long as she was mentally capable of doing the job and had the energy and enthusiasm to read all of the briefs, she was doing something that was good and something that was right, and that she was not going to step down. She was going to stay there and do her job. And yes, she could have stepped down during the Obama administration, and there would have been a different nominee than might be the nominee if there is a nominee in the next several months. but she felt that it was her duty to stay there. She was experienced in the Supreme Court. She was experienced in the ways of the court, and she was a good influence on the court. And she felt that as long as she could do the job, she would stay. And she felt that if ever she wasn't able to do the job, she would leave regardless of the administration. So I don't think she took it into account as to what the politics were. I don't think she was a person who wanted to be driven one way or the other by politics. And I give her credit for that. I give her credit for standing up and saying, as long as I can do the job and I think I'm doing it better than others would do it, she should stay there and do it. And as to whether I had any inkling that she was an extremist at this point, the answer is that she and I have corresponded back and forth by email quite regularly over many years. And I know that the emails stopped coming recently, and I knew that from my relationship with her son, who lives here in Chicago where I live, that her health was diminished. But I did not know that it was this late. You know, Ruth had several things that were miraculously found. She had several cancers over the last 20 years. And each time doctors found it through what I would call miraculous examinations, she would go in for a pain somewhere. They'd look, do some tests and x-rays and say, uh-oh, you need chemotherapy treatment. And so she had chemotherapy treatment several times over the last 15 or 20 years, and she survived them all. She was a survivor. She had the guts and the courage to go on. And I knew that the last few weeks that there was a recurrence of a type of cancer. And so I knew that there was a risk, but I didn't know how far it had come. I had sent her an email maybe 6 months ago saying, Ruth, God has helped you to find problems and cured them three different times. There were three different times over the last 15 or so years when she was at the hospital for some other kind of test and they discovered a cancer. And so I believed that maybe it would just go on. Maybe if there was a cancer now of the kidneys, maybe it would be found and she would go on. So no, I didn't know how bad it was until I got a call from her wonderful son, James, 3 minutes after she passed.
Well, Jack Levin, we so appreciate you spending some time with us tonight. We know this is a difficult moment for you and for Ruth's family, but the stories that you've been able to share with us really give us a better glimpse at the person that she was outside of who we all saw on the court. So we thank you for sharing those moments and those memories, and our thoughts are certainly with you and with her family tonight. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, and I take great pride in having known her when she achieved so much over these decades. Thank you.